The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
The Fold is brought to you by oOh!media, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Nau mai, hoki mai ki a The Fold, e mihi nei ko Duncan Greve tōko ngoa. My guests today are two absolute living legends of film in Aotearoa, people who were there for its birth and of, you know, have links into to TV, to advertising, basically the foundations of kind of modern film and TV culture in New Zealand. They are Lee Tamahori and Robin Scholes, and we are here to talk about The Convert, which is their new film out now. It's amazing. I watched it last night. It's, you know, set in the sort of pre-treaty era when it was just obviously a very different New Zealand, and it unintentionally really meets this moment. I don't want to give too much away, but yeah, it's a pretty special piece of filmmaking and came out of a kind of a fairly unique moment in the funding of our film, and we sort of get into some of that business kind of just general environment stuff with Robin. But we also look at their first collaboration, Once We're Warriors, and how that, you know, the sort of ferment that came from and the opportunities that opened up for them. You know, Lee Tamahori has got links, like I said, back to the start of New Zealand film in a modern sense. AD on films like Utu, Came a Hot Friday, worked on Goodbye Pork Pie, then founded Flying Fish, which is, you know, one of the biggest sort of commercial agencies in our history. Robin co-founded Communicado with Neil Roberts, which was one of the most important early production houses of the, you know, the modern era. Both of them sort of came up through that, you know, the great opening up of New Zealand under David Longie's Labour government. And there's just a sort of a poignancy, I think, to conducting this interview as we did less than a week after it was announced that TV3, the station which sort of for most of its existence embodied the possibility and attitude of that era, would be sort of changing and in quite a fundamental way. So that's sort of in the air of the conversation. Look, we recorded it at Sky City on location, so you know, there might be a few sort of funny little audio elements, but just an absolute honour to speak to these two. And yeah, really, really enjoyed it. This is Lee Tamahori and Robin Scholes on The Fold. Tēnā kōrua, Lee, Robin, welcome to The Fold.
Hi, nice to be here.
Lee, I watched the Convert last night. It's a gorgeous piece of filmmaking. I wondered about what attracted you to this story, and to rendering it in the way that you did.
Well, I've talked about this before, but it wasn't my idea to do this film at all. It was Robin's. And she came to me with a screenplay and said, "Are you interested in doing this film?" And I said, "No," because when I read it, it was a different screenplay, and I was not attracted to the lead character played by Guy Pearce, because he was a deeply religious man, almost a zealot, and I wasn't attracted to that character at all. I never am, and the cinema doesn't have many of them because, for obvious reasons. But Robin said, "Look, what would you could you give us a few notes on it? What would be, what you think is wrong with it? What you might do to fix it? So I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And I took a screenplay and I thought, well, something's missing here, something really. In the screenplay I had, it started in the town of Epworth. There was no beginning, there was no first act. There was no arrival of him in New Zealand. And so the old screenplay had was set in the town of Epworth, and there was a lot of time spent in Epworth and a lot of time on the boat, because he went from Epworth to Akatauri or Mainui, or whatever the characters were called. So I said I'd have a look at making a few suggestions, and the long story short is that I put together a little document, an outline of what if I was to make, stressing the terminology, if I was to donate this film, this is what I would do, but don't let the writers see this, for fuck's sake, you know, because they would just think I'm interfering in their screenplay and they won't see it any other way. But that's what I do as a director. And nobody teaches this in film school. You have to, in order to make the film you want to make, you've got to redirect the screenplay appropriately to where you want it to be. And because anyone can turn up and just start directing a screenplay that's there, sitting on the table. But you've got to have the ability to see into it. You kind of always edit it in your head, roughly, and then you put it to paper. And so what I did was I wrote down a bunch of ideas, and the more I got into it, I still kept telling Robin I wasn't going to do it. I said, this is what someone else might do, or some other director might want to do. And slowly I got drawn into it. I think it's part of her plot, actually, to get me into it. She knew I would say no and no and no, and then but I did. I got into it because it was a period that none of us know much about at all. It's a mystery. We know we sort of accustomed to dealing with the treaty and moving on from there. But prior to that, one of the first things that I was enamored of or fascinated by was the fact that it was a completely lawless society. British governance didn't come until about 1835 or 6 in any form whatsoever. And then it was governed from New South Wales. So the idea of somewhere around between whaling and sealing hitting the shores in the late 18th century and right up into the introduction of muskets, it was completely lawless land. I thought, that's an interesting Aotearoa to deal with, you know. Prostitutes, drunks in the towns in the north. And any civilization was in the north. And so I started to get into it, and it started to become clearer to me that this was a not important story to tell, but it's a reflective piece of our history, which I think has a lot of foundation. Because the Church Missionary Society, throwing out the Kendalls and Henry Williams in particular, was a, you know, the classic model of missionaries, then colonialism, then domination and land theft and everything. And so it was like a petri dish for it. So I thought, I started to get into it. I said to Robin, I'll make it after all the machinery of making the film started to go into place. But it was unusual because we were laughing about it earlier. That's exactly what happened with Once Were Warriors. Robin brought it to me I'd never made a film, I was making TV commercials. And she brought it to me as a screenplay and said, would you like to make this into a film? No, it wasn't as a screenplay, I think it was before the screenplay was even written. And I said, I'd read the book and I'd said, I said, make a terrible movie. I mean, it's a kiss of death, you know, you've got suicide, drugs, gangs, violence. And then she said, showed me the screenplay, and I read the screenplay and said, oh no, I don't know when I decided to do it. But when I decided to do it, I said, I'll only do it if I can change the screenplay. And this is no offence to Alan Duff, who had written a great book. but I didn't think the film would be the same thing. The reason being that you could drive a truck through the character that was Jake Hickey, and he would dominate the film totally, and unequivocally, and what it needed was more balance. So I said, we need to swing it from a female point of view, and you need to see it from the woman's angle, mother and daughter. And then you may get women to come and see it, and it might lighten the load a little on the, because every time Jake appears on film, on screen, he's going to dominate the scene anyway. So there was two scripts that I didn't want to do, and probably made my best films. Anyway, that's history.
I mean, looks like you've got a good technique for winning them around, Robin. I wondered if, I mean, watching it, I was sort of struck by the sort of how resonant it felt in terms of the current political moment. And, you know, that's not something you could have foreseen necessarily. Has that been something that has kind of played on your mind? Or what was it about, you know, putting together all the pieces that from a production side that made you want to get into it? And do you sort of see that it has that
resonance?
Yeah.
Well, I feel very, very underqualified to talk about the politics, but it does. It did interest me that way back in pre-treaty times, and you know, my scant knowledge of it was that there were some Europeans who really were very interested in Maori culture and adopted things from Maori culture and really wanted to do things differently from what they had done in their previous lives in England or Europe. And so and it was also interesting that a lot of the Maori chiefs were so strategic, you know, in the way in which they looked at for opportunities, like, for instance, controlling, you know, shipping, controlling sort of the growing of produce for the early settlers. The settlers were very, very dependent on Maori. So that relationship, you know, sort of those early days was interesting. And I had spent quite a lot of time in the Hokianga, and the Hokianga was had a lot of that history inherent in it. But in terms of, like, politics that reflect now, I think that, again, I'm superbly unqualified. I think that, that was a period of history when, you know, some Europeans, I guess you have to say it operated from mutual respect, that there were some Europeans who had total respect for a Maori way of life, didn't want to change it, were kind of curious and interested in it and wanted to see it maintained. And there were Maori who were really interested in European kind of ideas and how to, you know, use that within their own culture. But, and that in that in interest and intermarriage is also just something that is our foundation. But how it reflects on what's happening today is something that I can't comment about.
Fair enough.
I can.
Yeah, I'd love it if you would, Lee, because I think particularly of those closing scenes.
All life is political, no matter what anyone thinks. And I used to resist that argument myself until I found out that it's true. From local politics to national politics to the politics of the family, everything's political. And I'd known quite a bit about the history of this country, but not this early musket wars, this period pre-treaty. But talking about it being a timely comment on what's going on today, that's purely accidental. But there were active designs within the film to show what this country might have been like the very end sequence. So that might make any sense to anybody overseas, but to anyone in New Zealand who looks at it, You see, there's a Maori flag above the Union Jack. They made up a flag and put it up. And that was a direct comment on John Key's flag approach, you know, looking for a flag for us as a nation. And I said to Lisa Rehana, who designed it, I said, look, design me an excellent Maori flag and we'll put it in the picture. You know, we couldn't steal the Tino Rangatiratanga flag. So Maoris love flags, you know. Te Kōti's one is full of moons and white horses and crosses. And so there's things like that. They're subtly seeded all the way through it. But it's also, and then they walk off and defy the British authorities. So it's very careful not to tread on the treaty itself or go anywhere near it because it's such a volatile subject. It was me and my writer. I said, what we need here is a scene where the British are coming in to assert their authority, but it's not, can't really be related to history. It's not before the Declaration of Independence in 1835. That's why it's in 1834 or something at the end of the movie. But there's little things like that all the way through it. And Munro, being a humanist rather than a religious man, being a humanist and religious, echoes the sentiments of that are timeless. You know, some bigoted guy walks into his church and says, you know, we believe in a devout God, but they believe in twigs and leaves. They pray to twigs and leaves. And Munro says to him, surely if we're to live amongst them, we're going to have to adapt and blah, 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 blah. No, we won't. You know. There's a lot of little subtle politics riddled throughout the picture. But it was not designed with that intent because nobody wants to be beat over the head with a political mantra, you know.
Well, it's very much sort of implicit, but it was amazing. You just sometimes these things just have an accident of timing
I agree with you. This is an accident of timing, but a good one, I think.
Yeah, that was absolutely, you know, everyone has been saying that, oh, very timely.
I mean, the interesting thing about it being timely to me is that we worked very hard and very successfully to use te reo and English and have one person, a Māori character, can speak both languages, but one haltingly, and a Pākehā character can speak both languages, and then nobody can speak to each other, and they need an interpreter in between them. So
it's really beautifully arranged.
That was around the language, around te reo. Munro comes to understand that the language is the culture. That's just a side issue to the fact that in trying to step backwards in time, this current government trying to turn the clock back is flying in the face of empirical evidence that the language will survive any onslaught because the younger generation are coming along and embracing it. And Pākehā are embracing it too. And that's never as clear as the fact as when we had an Australian actress who spoke not a word of te reo, and she had to learn everything in te reo and be able to speak it fluently and act as in a Scottish accent. And then, of course, we have Munro speaking te reo in the end. But yeah, there's a little funny little parallels like that.
The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa, with over 4,000 out-of-home advertising sites nationwide across both street furniture and retail centres. I'm super grateful to oMedia for enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
So we're recording this less than a week after the news came out about three, which will be, you know, if this goes through, it will exist in name, but not a lot else in some respects. And you both started your career at the very beginnings of a sort of a more commercial or more vibrant media era in this country and built companies around that. Robin, I was wondering if you could sort of, you know, recall those days for us about, you know, what it felt like to be flying the plane, to be sort of inventing the stuff as you went. It was certainly, it looks that way from this distance.
A lot of fun, to be honest. Yes, we began Comunicado with a partnership of four people, Neil Roberts, who was a journalist, and his brother, Murray Roberts, who had an accounting background, and Gary McAlpine, who was Neil's friend and who was a teacher. And from the get-go, sort of we decided that we had to, sort of to be sustainable, we would have to earn money from multiple sources. So we had corporate entertainment, we provided and did videos for Air New Zealand that they played on the plane in those old days. I reckoned we had to have like information type shows, so I devised a business show. And then both Neil and I, Neil started off with a show called That's Fairly Interesting. And I started, you know, sort of, you know, coming up with ideas for shows and making them. Basically, you know, we could, you go in at that point in time. I mean, a classic example of, in terms of our history was, you know, Neil and I went into, we're going to sell our ideas. We basically have a sheet of paper and we'd have a paragraph of each idea and we'd pitch it verbally, right, to the programmer. And then, you know, we'd walk out and we'd have four of the six ideas commissioned. But this is the classic thing, you know, we kind of like one day we walked out and we'd, I think it was Ross Plapp who was the programmer, and Neil went, there have been four of them. In other words, there were four heads of programming and since we'd began, and that was over a four-year period, I think, and we're still here. And we realised that, you know, kind of, okay, so this is sustainable. We can go on, you know, coming up with ideas and pitching them and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we made, like when I look back on, you know, the stuff that we made, just made an enormous, you know, like a lot of, for instance, Harold Anderson, who was the head of programming at one stage, phoned me and said, "Ah, Robin, we've got a lot of archive here, you know, like famous New Zealanders. Can you make something out of that?" And that became Magic Kiwis, which was, you know, telling little docudramas about famous New Zealanders. So it was wide open. I mean, we, apart from the Gibson Group in Wellington, South Pacific sort of was mainly, you know, drama. Sort of we arrived at a time when it was possible to create such a company, to have a collaboration between partners in that way. You know, for those first few years, it was, you know, really, I mean, we could do, we built a big company, a big substantial company. at a certain point, I think it was, you know, after about 5-7 years, we had a board meeting. These are classic board meetings, which we decided, okay, Neil will do commercials, we'll add commercials, and Robin, you can do drama. And that was where, you know, kind of Once a Warriors, story about Once a Warriors came in, because I walked out of that board meeting and we'd employed a guy called Robert Boy Bell at that point in time, who just read Once a Warriors. And he literally, big open plan office, right? So he literally threw the book at me. "If you're going to make a film, make this," he said. So yeah, they were, that it was very different climate. I mean, in a way, a trust that, it's a trust that people could make something that would work for an audience. Now there is no trust, because people have a lot of regulations and rules and the sense that you cannot be trusted to make something without being regulated is the key point of difference for me.
That's really interesting. Where do you feel that radiating from? Is that from, like, say, the Film Commission? Is that from producers? Where does that...
Everywhere.
How do you feel?
You try dealing with resource consent to use a location in Auckland. It's just, we've developed a... we've developed rules and regulations which prevent bad things happening, but they also are very restrictive.
Stop good things happening too.
Yeah, just restrictive on... You have to really have a certain mental fortitude to survive, kind of ticking all the boxes. The Film Commission is not the only... I know the Film Commission is their portal is quoted by a lot of producers as something that is really onerous to navigate because there are so many conditions that you have to meet. But that's just indicative of, as a society, we've become, we've become more and more bureaucratic. And layers and layers of bureaucracy have overlain what we can do. So it's true. It was much freer in the 80s than it is now. Now, if you're going to make something, you've got to, answer all, tick all the boxes. And I have no qualms about that, to be honest, because I think you are in control of what you make. So no matter if you've got to tick all these boxes on the side, actually no one's going to come and check. And when you produce the goods, if it works... Because the box ticking exercise is incredibly subject to interpretation,
but still be creative
making
around
something
it.
That works for an audience, is kind of like basically that's still up to you. So I see them as two separate things. Yeah, I've got to jump through those hoops in order to do that, but that's what it takes.
One of the things which has had a lot of scrutiny lately is the sort of financing environment, the incentive environment for film in New Zealand. What is your kind of current take on our settings and how hard it is to create a budget and a pathway for a film to get made and then succeed?
So it has changed, obviously. So when we made Once the Warriors, there was actually only one source of funding. There were no rebates. So we had less than $1 million to make the whole film, which even at that point in time was considered to be a very low budget. As time has gone on, we have the rebate, which has been incredibly beneficial. And it is beneficial in terms of its ability to give revenue to government because as you know, every dollar you spend is taxed and the government earns from that money. So the rebate ends up being a small portion of what the revenue the government gets from it. So rebate's been really crucial in our ability to be able to use rebate, for instance, on both sides, like with The Convert, it's an Australian-New Zealand co-production, so we're able to use the Australian offset plus the SPIG in New Zealand to help finance it. But the reality is when I developed The Convert, thought of it as a small film because it was originally with a first-time director. I thought I may be able to raise about $3 million. And as I developed it further, I realised it would be a big film. I had no idea of how I would finance it. It just became bigger and bigger. And COVID happened. And the government, the Labor government, decided to put a fund together that was like a rescue rescue package for the film and the screen industry, basically. So it was managed by Te Manga Pāho, New Zealand On Air, and the Film Commission. It was called the Premium Production Fund, meaning it was for higher end sort of film and television, including documentary, that would have an international audience. Now, we were a recipient of that, plus we got international money, plus we had the money from Australia offset and New Zealand's big. And that combination enabled us to do something of scale. The Premium Production Fund no longer exists. So unless a similar fund is created, our ability to fund pure drama stories like this is really, really limited. So where there is an ability to fund a material, it's mainly with genre. So if you make a horror film, a thriller, a comfy crime, TV series, these are known genres, or a fight movie, these are known genres, and it's a little bit easier to raise finance. But drama and the sort of scale and this kind of story that we told in The Convert is impossible to make without that additional funding. And I can't see how a government can justify putting together a fund like that in these times when we are strapped for cash totally. So I think we've got to be thinking of other ways to fund things. I've got ideas about how you could do that, which is largely to do with, making more genre films that you can actually get private investors into because there is a return on those and using income from those films to help support the occasional drama. It's a really interesting time, and it's we have to come up with new ways of funding everything. The thing that the focus should also be on the streamers. The streamers are kind of responsible for taking a lot of revenue away from the local industry, and other countries have managed to get them to pay some funds into development and into funding New Zealand or local stories. I think that's something that we have got to work on. Jane Campion's been successful in getting Netflix to put some money into a school for directors. That's a beginning. So, that's kind of where we need to look to actually, taxing the people who are responsible for destroying a lot of our industry.
Yeah, it's quite poignant to think that, shows like After the Party or films like The Convert, which have been so successful in building a sort of a different level of execution than we can typically do, that they will be remembered as a blip rather than the beginning of something potentially, and unless there is that change. But it doesn't look like it at the moment.
No, we had it once before with the large film grant, the fund that funded films like The World's Fastest Indian and Whale Rider. Not sure whether The World's Fastest Indian was in that, but, it funded a Whale Rider. So it may be when we recover a bit more economically, it may be possible to put something like that together. And it may be possible to put something like that together now with a kind of, private funding, which was underwritten by the Film Commission.
Lastly, Lee, you referred earlier to the some sort of uncanny common elements to the origin stories and the relationship with Robin around Once Were Warriors and the Convert. What do you see as the common elements in terms of the sort of story or intention there, but also how do you think you have sort of grown or changed in terms of how you've approached this story versus that one over the years?
I haven't changed much at all, actually. In fact, all the films, the script is everything. And you get the script right, then your film is going to be okay. It may not be the best film, but it won't be the worst either. So the big difference between this and Once Were Warriors is Once Were Warriors, I didn't know what I was doing because we had to rewrite the script. I had to bring in a playwright, a Māori playwright called Rivia Brown, to give the women voice. And I said to her, I said, look, Rivia, we're sailing into uncharted territory. You know, I've never written a script before. You've never made a film, or so to speak. You know. But we'll write it together. And we did. We just thrashed out the script and gave it to a few friends to see if what was wrong with it and the fish hooks in it. They got fixed up. We went ahead and shot it. It was like, but now I've learned over the years that the director's input into the script is kind of critical. Not a lot of directors do this, but you have to. I find that I have to. That you guide the screenwriter. If you have to completely pull a script apart, you guide the writer, whoever he or she is, with the knowledge that I want this scene here because that needs to dovetail with that, and it needs to look like that. And they can't hear anything because the wall's too solid. So we have to find a way of filming it, blah, 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 blah. So now I'm much more at ease with manipulating and adapting a screenplay. And indeed on this one, I did a huge amount of the writing. All the structural work is mine. There's not much left from the original script that Robin gave me. So I've got more confidence over the years to be able to put a shootable script in front of people. And it should read well. And everyone that's read the script, the people, the crew and everyone, the cast, all wanted to be on it because the script was so exciting. And your investors are going to read the same thing. Oh, yeah, we'd like to put some money into that because it really sounds like a good, solid adventure or whatever. Yeah. So I guess that's the only difference. But otherwise, it's the same. You just sit there and think of the characters and what they'd be doing in this situation. Would they do this? Would they not do that? And sometimes you come up and you write some clunky stuff and it turns out to be terrible. But it's easy to discard it and rewrite it on the day. While we were shooting, in fact, I've done that all the time, most of the time. But especially on this one, there's scenes that are happening in front of you and they're all scripted and the actors are doing what they are saying, what they're supposed to. And you go, no, this is not working. To yourself, don't say anything, do the whole scene without dialogue. And the actors go, oh, okay. So you go back into their workshop phase and they sit down and do the whole thing as a mime act or something. But then the audience is sitting there going, oh, what's that? Are they doing that? Oh my God, that's because of that. So you let the audience do the work.
In terms of, no one seemed to anticipate it, but obviously Once Were Warriors travelled extraordinarily well and really struck a chord. Do you, this, has a similar kind of, it's an intensely New Zealand story, has a huge amount of te reo Māori in it, but equally there must be an expectation from yourself, from investors, that it too might have a chance to go beyond here. Do you see that and what's the sort of the thinking there?
You never know. So basically you sort of, we didn't think that Once Were Warriors would travel. I mean, I'd done this whole, we're both pretty gung-ho to have it play in a multiplex. So back then, sort of Force Corporation had built these big cinemas. And up until that point in time, most New Zealand films had been exhibited in smaller art house cinemas. So we were gung-ho about take it to the masses, and we screened it for ourselves in Newmarket, and then came and had a cup of coffee, sort of afterwards. Oh God, maybe it's too tough. And then amazingly, everyone embraced it because you do not know. You don't know. Sort of how people will react. We feel confident about New Zealand audiences because it feels very much a New Zealand story. It's being sold by a really great sales agent internationally. And the results of that will come through over this year, because it takes a while to roll through those deals. Often if there's a universal truth at the heart of something, it will work internationally. Once Warriors was, you can escape, you can change your life. So I think everyone responded to that. And also it was because it was a female story, everyone responded to the fact that a woman could walk away, change her life, you know, save herself, save her children. Sort of that was a kind of universal theme that people responded to.
Well, like I said, having watched it last night, it's a pretty stunning achievement, and yeah, we wish you both the best, and thank you so much for taking the call to talk about it.
That was The Fold, brought to you by our partners at oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Huge thanks to oMedia for sponsoring this episode of The Fold and enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today. The Spinoff Podcast Network.